You're listening to Red Nation Online.
You're listening to the Paul James and Soccer Podcast. Commentary and analysis by Paul James, former Canadian soccer player, television analyst, coach, and member of the Canadian Soccer Hall of Fame.
Well, here we are with episode 36 of the Paul James on Soccer podcast, and it was a relatively quiet week in Canadian soccer, with the MLS expansion draft being the big story for the Montreal Impact, Toronto FC, and Vancouver Whitecaps alike. The MLS expansion draft was held last Wednesday, and the Montreal Impact picked up 12 MLS players to stock their roster for their first season in the league, with most of the ink around the draft having been spilled on the controversy with Brian Ching. In my eyes, Montreal also did get a few decent players in Justin Mapp, Colin Warner, Sana Niasse, and Justin Braun. Paul, I'm wondering, how do you think Montreal did in their expansion draft?
Yeah, I think they did well, Steve, based on what I know of some of those players and from what I've observed. Justin Mapp, for example, is he's a very good player. He's in many ways a game breaker. You know, he scores some great goals, and at the right time in the right environment, I think he could be a great get for Montreal. Niasse is okay. He's a great athlete, very quick. Technically, I haven't always been as impressed. I think he's just he just lacks that extra bit of class in and around the box. You know, it always seems like he loses in his final touch. And the other thing to keep in mind, you know, when you do these expansion drafts, you know, each team gets to protect 11 players, 11 obviously their best players. So, there has to be some flaw with most of the players in terms of being in the top echelon of the MLS right now. You know, I think Justin Mapp, when he first came into the league, was one of the top youngsters and top prospects. But as the years evolve, he's proven himself to be just an okay player, and maybe not quite reached his potential, and it might be reached his potential yet, which hopefully he can do in Montreal. But I think, you know, whenever you talk about, like, the Niasse, I used to get excited about him when I watched him, but then over time, you know, the more I saw him, I thought, well, you can see why he would not be protected and would not be in the top 11 players, because I see some technical flaws. So I think each of them, we need to keep that always in perspective when you talk about expansion drafts. You know, it's not to say there's not some diamonds in the rough, and there certainly are. And I have to say this, you know, the way they're going about their business, Montreal, which would be under the leadership of Marsh, that, time will tell. I mean, I was excited about Vancouver last year with some of the things they were doing, and they didn't do so well. But Montreal really seem like they've got their eye on the ball, and what Marsh is doing is that by Christmas, he's just about have his team in place, the squad of players in place, so they get into the new year. He has no worries about having the right amount of players. He's going to have quality in each of the positions that are important. That's first and foremost from the spine, from the goalkeeper to the center of the park, from the center backs into the forwards. You know, he's going to have a good balance there, and then you just get on with it. It's really then about coaching. You know, we talked about Mo Johnson in the first year. He just wheeled and dealed all the time and, you know, tried to get success by, if a player had a bad game, by moving them out and bringing in somebody else to see if that fitted. Well, that's not it. It's that you go out and you try your best to get the best available talent and coach them, and you coach your way through difficult times. So I really like Marsh, what he's done since he's been there, the players he's moved out and the ones that he's bringing in. And who knows, Justin Mapp might be the diamond in the rough, although if they can persuade Brian Ching to come in, then clearly he will be the top get in this particular draft.
Yeah, I've been impressed too, and I think one other thing to consider with the expansion draft is sometimes that some of these players are available, you know, not because they're terrible or not of any use. It's just that at the salary they're at this point in their career, that maybe their teams feel like that money could be better used for you know, on another player.
Yeah, it's true, and I think that's a really good point. I think it's a good point to bring up. There are strategic things, but in general, and first of all, none of them are terrible players. I mean, if you're on a roster of 18 or 22 players in an MLS team, you're decent. There's no doubt about it, no matter what. But, you know, when you build a team, you want the very best to be able to compete for to win championships or to make playoffs. So when you do the expansion, you know that these players are not in that top 11. And again, you've addressed, I think it's right, is that there are some strategic elements. But, but generally you're dealing with, at that moment in time, is the quality of the league, what it stands for in terms of the quality, is that you're still dealing with the second tier of players when you're making those draft decisions.
Well, Montreal followed up the expansion draft by actually acquiring a couple of veteran MLS players, and I think quite good ones, in keeper Donovan Ricketts from Los Angeles and Davy Arnault from Sporting Kansas City. You know, how do you like those moves?
Yeah, I think they're good. I think there's a goalkeeper there. Ricketts is decent. I mean, he didn't play all the time in LA, but he was decent enough. He's got good experience and great physical presence. So, you know, goalkeeping's so important, as any coach will know, and I think particularly in the MLS. So I like that very much. The Warner guy is a good player from what I've seen. You know, here's the thing: when we talk about these players from other teams, is that if you see them once or twice a year, you still don't get a real perspective on, as opposed to when we see Vancouver or Toronto all the time. You know, you really get to see what the players' strengths and qualities are, and weaknesses. So, you know, it's a little bit, to say that, he's a great get, based on the fact I've seen him score a few goals for Kansas City and, from long range. It's a stretch, but nevertheless, I think Marsh clearly knows what he's doing, clearly knows what he wants as far as the assembling a team. I mean, knows what he's doing. He knows what he wants, and that's, I think, very clear because he's very decisive in making these decisions. He's quick, he's sharp. It took him like a few weeks to come in and move out the players he needed to move out. I think the Brian Ching one is a really interesting, situation, though.
Yeah, I mean, that selection of Ching, you know, Montreal made something of a bold move considering that Brian Ching had said in advance of the draft that he was going to retire if Montreal selected him. You know, what do you make of the situation, and do you think this is another example of, the type of xenophobia that we've sometimes seen from American athletes who've been drafted to play for Canadian teams in other sports?
Yeah, I think it's, I'm not sure about xenophobia being a part of any American that doesn't want to come to Canada. You know, it's... We're different cultures, but we're not as extreme as what it would be from going to from Asia to England or to continental Europe. So I don't think it's that at all, Steve. I think that what they are trying to do here, and I actually liked Ian Clark's article on it on your website. I think last week, I thought it was an excellent article. And I thought he really hit it. Is that Houston and probably Brian Ching here are trying to get the best of all worlds here. It's that they're trying to protect 11 players, knowing that Ching is not going to come and not move from Montreal. And I get that part as well, right? He's 33, going on 33, so he doesn't want to move in the upheaval from going down south and coming all the way up to Montreal and into Canada. I don't think it's been in Canada specifically. I think it really is about not wanting to move out of the comfort zone. So the bottom line is here is that if that's the case, they needed to say, right, well, do we protect him? And they made the decision, no. And I don't think it's because that they didn't value him in the top 11. I think they're trying to, not so much to pull a fast one on Montreal, because clearly Montreal have called their bluff on it. But it really is about trying to get, have your cake and eat it too. I think, as Ian Clark said, it's a risk. And now it's really interesting to see what happens, because okay, so Chin says, I'm going to retire. Fair enough. But from what I can see on the MLS salaries, he gets he's due to get $412,000. I mean, I don't know what he's going to go out and do when the outside of football, but he'll do well to make $400,000 doing something else. You know, you wouldn't get that in the media. You won't get it in too many other places unless he's got, great skill set. So I would say most players would move anywhere to to make that kind of money for a few more years when you're in the twilight of your career. So I don't buy that so much, and I think if I was Montreal, I would have done exactly the same thing. What you do is that if you've got top players in that expansion draft, you draft them, and then you work out business. You know, and I think that's what it is for Montreal. This is what I like about March, from what I can see, and Joey Saputo on the top there is clearly in touch with everything about what's going on, and he's allowing Marsh to do his business. But it is, business is business. If you don't protect a top-flight player, then the team should pick them up for sure. And I think that's what Montreal have done. Now it's about negotiating. It's about negotiating. Does he come in? No. Or does he retire? Well, again, $400,000 is what you could get for a season. And I think ultimately what's going to happen is that he is will probably be traded somewhere, and we'll end up back in Houston. And that's ultimately what you want. But Houston have tried to put themselves in a position where they protect 11 solid players that they're really excited about, some of the younger players, so they don't lose them. But they've also tried to still get Brian Chin to come back there, but not protecting him because he said that he was not going to go anywhere else anyway. So if they want him, and if he wants to still be playing, they're going to have to work out a deal. It's a good move by Montreal, very clever in my opinion. I would have done that for sure, and I'm sure it'll work out, hopefully for everybody. But Houston are not going to get off scot-free. They're going to have to give up something, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Montreal is obviously going to get something back, you know, from making that play. You know, the MLS has generally been, as a single entity, has actually been pretty good about, you know, moving players around to, places where they actually want to live and play. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. It certainly, you're right, giving up $400,000, you can say it before the draft, but it's a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, Steve, I mean, if it was, if he's making $80,000, right, and you're at that age and you've got family, you're just not going to do that. Even if you're making $120,000, you say, fair enough. But, you're making $400,000, that's the life of a professional player, just like in hockey. You get traded, you move. And if you don't and you retire, fair enough, no problem. But what are you going to do to make $400,000 for another couple of years? Yeah, always round. I think great move from Montreal, that one.
Well, Toronto FC made it through the expansion draft unscathed and didn't lose a player. The Vancouver Whitecaps did lose a player in midfielder Jeb Borowski. You and I both watched every Whitecaps game that the team played last season and saw a lot of Borowski, who Tom Soane seemed to rate highly as a versatile player, who also had a positive character and, was able to play a number of positions, including defensive midfielder and right back. You know, what are your thoughts on Borowski as a player, and what do you think he'll bring to Montreal in his first season?
Yeah, well, I think you've said it in the question. I think, again, it's about Marsh. What Marsh has recruited there and drafted is character, is a player that's flexible and versatile, can play in a number of positions. And somebody of experience now, he's had good experience from that year in Vancouver. I think it's a real good choice. I'm surprised Vancouver didn't protect him, but Rennie, we get an idea, and we get Tommy Soane's perspective, and we've seen him play in different positions. I mean, he didn't light the world on fire for me, but he was a decent enough player, good enough player, and what would have trumped it for me would have been the character part and his work ethic and, an approach on and off the field. I would have thought that would have been something worth keeping. But, Vancouver might have those 11 players that they're comfortable with. That it just so happens that he's 12th on their list. So he gets not protected and he gets picked up. It's about, really doing your homework, knowing your stuff. And it does appear to me that that as soon as somebody of quality, whether that be in terms of character and attitude or flexibility and where they can play or just talent, is that as soon as they're available, they get plucked up. And it shows that Montreal are in touch with that, because I think that's a good get. He would be somebody I would have gone after for he would be a connector within your team environment. When you have a positive character, you can't have enough of those positive characters. So that, he'll be a real connector within that changing room and, on the field and the approach. He's just a great guy. Low maintenance, for sure, he will be.
Yeah, the other thing with Borowski was He now has a year under his belt. He was a rookie last year. You know, do you expect him to be, you know, to make a bit of a jump in terms of his confidence and his overall playing ability within the league now that it's his second year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I think it's, you know, that is a factor as well. But, you know, to actually, you could look at it from the perspective of, you know, judge about what other people think of him. The fact that he is, you know, young and still inexperienced and he gets picked up, that tells you a lot about his positive qualities. And his positive qualities clearly are his character and attitude. So I like that part. I'm pretty sure Vancouver were hoping that they didn't lose him, but they have, so that's just the nature of the business.
Now, looking at the expansion draft from Toronto FC standpoint, you know, they didn't lose anyone. I'm wondering, what do you think, what does that say about the depth on Toronto FC?
Yeah, I mean, it says an awful lot. You know, to not lose anybody, not too many teams were in that situation, it's not good. I think it's a reflection of what Aaron Vinter has there, and we could say partly he's inherited, but he's also assembled, you know, some players who are not quite good enough and don't quite fit in. So they have their own work to do. The De Guzman one was really interesting, but at the same time, I think particularly how it played out in the end, in the media and way Toronto FC pitch it, you know, was saying that they felt confident that it was not going to be a losing situation for them. They weren't going to lose De Guzman. But I have to say, if we're honest here and looking at probably Toronto FC management and executive people would have, and they're not going to say this, I shouldn't say the executive, I would say the technical people, they would have probably been okay with losing De Guzman. If De Guzman would have got picked up by Montreal, they would have not said it directly. They would have wished him well and thanked him for his commitment. But I think they would have been okay and would have been happy for them to get themselves a new DP. And again, it's not about that Julian's a bad player. He certainly isn't. It's not about him necessarily being a bad character at this stage. I think he's matured over the years. But it certainly is about, when we talk, use that phrase again, so I'm using it again, but it's business is business. And Toronto FC, you know, still lack the pedigreed quality. When you look at LA and they have, you know, Robbie Keane, David Beckham and Landon Donovan, you know, three top flight players, is that Toronto FC, you know, really don't have that. And they can beat LA on any given day, and they can beat and they can compete, you know, in this league, you know, in bits and pieces. But if you want sustained success, you're definitely going to have, you know, three of your top players, which are DP players. They've got to be your top players. And they've got to have an influence on games, game in, game out. They've got to have influence, you know, across the league, be top flight. And, you know, for me, Julian is not going to be that throughout his career here in the MLS. And as soon as he plays or makes a good pass, we get excited about it. As soon as he plays a half-decent game, you know, we go out of our way, it seems, in the media to be excited about it. But when you sober up and really look at it for what it is that as a DP player, you know, he's not going to be quite at that level. So I think quite at that level that they need to be able to build a legitimate winner in this city. So they're either going to have to sit on De Guzman's contract for the next year and then decide to sign him again and see him out his career here in Toronto. Or they got to make a tough decision and free up a DP spot. So I think it's interesting if they've left him off, they were hoping, I think, for him to get picked up. That's for sure. They won't admit that clearly because that's they have a management issue. But you've got to read between the lines. You don't leave off it. If it's a top pedigree player, even if it's DP, you don't leave them off your protected list for any number of reasons. But you know, the biggest one is that you don't lose them. But you know, so I thought that was really interesting as far as Toronto FC. I think it's a sad reflection on their depth, as you said, Steve, that nobody gets picked up. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's not about being negative on Toronto FC. I think they're in touch. I think they've got they've got their own plan and own vision. And as it stands now, based on last year, Toronto FC is well ahead of Vancouver. Now it'd be interesting to see how Rennie goes about his business, but right now Toronto FC is definitely ahead of the other Canadian teams, and they should be, I suppose, because of their experience now after 5-6 years. But be interesting how it's going to work out, next season for them.
Yeah, and obviously, Vinter, Mariner, and DeClercq, they hit a couple home runs already with the signings of the two DPs that they brought in the summer.
But let me just sort of cut you off there, Steve. But, yes, with Kuvermans alike and Frings, but there's some flaws there, for sure. Frings is going to be, 34, 35, and he showed a few flaws. He's a great player. He's a terrific player, there's no doubt. But we'll see over time, we'll see.
I guess what I was trying to get at is I would figure any incoming coach, are going to inherit a certain number of players, but they probably really would want to pick their own DPs and not have to inherit DP players.
Oh, you're on about Marsh in Montreal?
Yeah.
I totally agree with that.
And Julian wasn't the only one that was available. There were a couple others, including Jarju. So it's certainly going to be an interesting story to follow.
Yeah, but let's be honest with Jarju, is that, in my opinion, he's not good enough for when you took, clearly not good enough. I mean, and Guzman's not good enough to be making $2 million as a DP player in this league either. So they're both left off because of that reason, ultimately. Whichever way you want to shape it, I think Vancouver would have been doing cartwheels in their offices if Jarju would have been picked up. They've made an error there. There's no doubt about that. But I think your point is absolutely valid, is that the real reason there in Montreal, from Montreal's perspective, is that they don't need to waste a spot on picking up a DP when they can go and search the globe to go get a DP that would be better than what was available. And it is a reflection, really. And it's backup to say also that the DPs that were available are just not at the right level for what a DP should be.
So looking at Toronto FC's current roster, they obviously have some work to do, but they don't have a whole lot of assets in terms of bringing in new impact players. So they're going to need to be creative. And, this past week, there was an interesting rumor that popped up, that the team was interested in former TFC midfielder Pablo Vitti, who's been playing in Peru since he left Toronto in 2009. Well, this may just be one of those rumors that never amounts to anything legitimate. It does bring forward an interesting point of discussion. As a technical and creative Argentinian player, Vitti was considered by most to have been a failure in his time with Toronto, as well as a player whose game looked unsuited to the physicality and style of the MLS. At the same time, some are now of the opinion that he could be the exact type of player who could thrive in the system that Aaron Vinter has instituted at the club. Paul, what do you think about the idea of Pablo Vitti returning to Toronto FC?
Well, unless I need my eyes tested and laser eye surgery, Steve, I mean, I just didn't see it. I thought he was decent enough, but certainly not at the quality that you would want from an international player coming in to compete in this league. There are glimpses for sure. I mean, you see the South American part to it. But in terms of going out and recruiting, boy, oh boy, you've got the globe to search for the right players. Is that I just don't see that he would be, I would be disappointed, as far as the quality just wasn't there. He didn't have an impact game in, game out. You saw, brief glimpses of what the Latin American part of his game was. But, it was about having an impact on the game, and I didn't quite see it, to be honest. So, I think that's interesting. It's a rumor, and it's great to be part of a footballing culture now that has rumors, because that is what happens all over the world, and rumors come from all different from different areas of the industry and for different agendas and for different reasons. So I would say it's more along those lines, unless we have completely missed it. The supporters that weren't enamored with him and myself, maybe we've missed it, and maybe there is some real quality about him. But I think I would lean more to that being an unfounded rumor.
Whether there's any truth to the rumor or not, one thing that excites me is the fact that the team could actually be looking towards South America. And I think Peru in particular is a good country to be looking at, you know, just in terms of, you know, maybe getting players whose salary expectations aren't going to be quite so high.
Yeah, not just, I would say Latin America, I would say the CONCACAF countries, you know, the Central American countries. You know, when you talk about gems, there's going to be gems down there for sure, and the price is going to be right. You know, the, you know, it really is about having a great scouting eye and a scouting network. And the South American players will be better accustomed to dealing with the climactic things in North America, you know, and even the travel to, you know, to a certain extent. So I like that strategy if they're going to go down to South America, because they you definitely get some real quality. And I know Dallas were poor in the end towards the end of the season. Their season went pear-shaped on them, but you know, again, you can really see the quality all over the park of the individual athletes and Latin brand. I suppose in everything, Steve, it's again the balance part too. You know, you can get the right European players in to do a good job, and I think Aaron Winter and Bob de Klerk have done a decent job of getting you know, Sulzmer is who I'm thinking of. It's not a DP player, but an international player is decent. You know, you can pluck players out from around the world that are decent enough at the right price. But I definitely like the fact that they would be looking south and to South America to get a couple. I think that's the kind of spice and an extra bit of something special that Toronto FC need.
Now, changing the topic a bit, we spoke about Dwayne DiRosario's win as MLS MVP on last week's podcast. And in reviewing the chatter on discussion boards and via the blogosphere surrounding his award and what it means to his legacy as a player, one point that I came across several times was via several soccer fans who are still very dismissive of the MLS compared to the European and South American leagues. You know, and while I figure those types of attitudes will probably always be around in the minds of some, you've stated on many occasions that the quality of play in the MLS is high and that it's constantly improving. You know, furthermore, no less an authority than Arsene Wenger has pointed to America, along with Asia, as the areas where the next great players will come from. You know, so obviously MLS isn't the EPL, it isn't La Liga or the Bundesliga, but I'm curious how you think the MLS compares to other leagues in Europe, Asia, and South America in 2011.
Yeah, well, you said a number of things. First of all, I think Wenger makes that statement because he understands the cultural parts of the world and world football and what it means. I mean, in Asia, you've got a population thing, and you've got the soccer is a huge sport in those cultures, and the investment now through globalization is huge. And so, you know, when you do that and you have the cultural ethic, work ethic of some of those nations, that they're going to be determined to be world footballing powers. And then United States, whichever way you look at the United States, you know, let's leave soccer for now, but the sport in modern United States has always been about being the best in the world. That they strive for that in whatever sport, and the sporting model through the collegiate system has worked well for them. It's not perfect for football and soccer necessarily, but it's worked well for them, and they've got the investment, they've got the participation numbers, they've got resources, and where geography doesn't quite work, geography and climate doesn't work quite the same way in Canada. In the United States, it very much does, because of the you know, the southern climates that are warm year round. So they have access to everything in the United States, and along with the participation numbers, along with the sporting ethos, that's a really important part of their culture. You can see where Wenger is coming from. He knows that they're going to be. Once you start getting the top flight athletes in the United States going into soccer, which you sort of get now to a certain extent, you sort of get some of the better athletes that are competing in soccer. It's you know, it's a great indication of what's to come. But in terms of the other part of your question, I would say that the MLS is a good league and I like it. You know what I mean about it is that you turn up to a game, you pay your money, you sit in the stands, and then you watch the game. And you cannot leave that and say that it's not, you haven't been entertained from a sporting perspective. It more than meets the minimum standard of first-class professional soccer. There's no doubt about that. You know, there's been times, I suppose, you could watch MLS games and they've been, you know, really poor. And, you know, I'm sure in their first number of years they had some growing pains as far as the overall level and quality. But now it's very competitive. And the money and the investment in it, the interest, the media coverage is significant. And again, still the majority of players in it are American. So the budgets are kept, at a lower level. But as a result of that, by the way, though, is that you ultimately judge the level of the league compared to others around the world. And that's where, when you quantify it, you cannot compare the MLS to the top European leagues or top leagues around the world, because money dictates. You know how well your league is doing on a quality level by the salaries that you pay. That's the bottom line on a business level, because the best players gravitate towards the money. You know, it's that supply and demand thing. You know, and how long you have is your career. You've got to maximize your potential. So if you can make triple somewhere else around the world, you go. So until they correct that, that really the MLS is not going to be competing with, I would say a number of leagues, not just the top leagues, but a number of leagues around the world. But having said that, it still is, you know, to me, a quality league, getting better and better every year because of the competitive nature of it. As soon as they can do a readjustment, a realistic readjustment to the way that they treat salaries, and it's a mindset now, because it's actually entrenched in the owners and into Don Garber of keeping that cost, they will say keeping that cost under control, but it's an impediment right now, in my opinion, to developing the league to the next level. They need to somehow make an adjustment that's more realistic to build bigger, stronger squads, to attract maybe a few more international players per team. And then the quality will improve even more. But overall, there's no doubt, since Toronto FC have come in and they've done those expansions in Portland and in particularly in Seattle and now into Montreal, it gets more competitive, and it's definitely exciting and entertaining to watch. And you've just got to look at the goals of the year. It's absolutely fantastic. The top 10 goals were all terrific. So, you know, that's a really good indication. And I don't compare it to the rest of the world in terms of how I would view the quality. I would say it's about, when you go to games or watch games on TV, are you entertained? If the answer is yes, then that's good enough so far for me.
With 19 teams now operating in the North American top flight, including three in Canada, North American players now have more opportunity to apply their trade at home than they ever have in the past. And for many talented young players, they now have a very serious choice to make with respect to their careers and development as players. You know, the question they have to ask themselves is, should they stay at home, as Bryce Alderson has chosen to do with the Vancouver Whitecaps, or try to make their way in Europe, as Alderson's fellow Canadian U17 teammate Kevin Allman appears to have done. Now, obviously, countries like Germany, Italy, England, and Spain offer coaching, competition, and infrastructure that's been built up over a period of 100 years, and thus offer opportunity that is still superior to what is available in Canada and the United States. That said, do you think that the MLS now offers a comparable or better opportunity for young players than some of the secondary soccer nations in Europe?
For sure. Absolutely. And, you know, talk about the quality and how good is the quality of the MLS. Well, it's because a number of the players, and you just got to look at some of the Canadian players that haven't made it to Toronto FC and still applying their trade now over in Europe. You know, whether it's Miguel Canizales, Chris Pozniak, they didn't quite make it here, or weren't deemed good enough to be playing in the MLS here, but they go over and play in second tier leagues over there. It's great, it's good for them. But I think it is a reflection on the quality and the standards that are being set, you know, over here. So I would say for younger players, it really comes to the real quality. I remember Paul Pesciolito from years ago in the old Canadian Soccer League. You know, and he was absolute quality at that, in that particular era. That, when he decided to go to Europe, was going to make it because he was that good. But a lot of the other younger players at that stage that were in and around him, you know, even though they went on to Europe, some of them wouldn't have been able, it wasn't a guarantee that they were going to be able to go over there and do that. So I would say for younger players, if they're going to go over to Europe and try and make it, you know, you really have to, in order for that to be a success, they have to be of that special quality, you know. And then the next tier down would be the Bryce Saldersons that would, you know, it's still a terrific player, and they get great opportunity now to play in the domestic game. So it's interesting with Ullman, whether, I'm not sure whether that's Vancouver not wanting to sign him. With Toronto FC, it was clearly, I like Toronto FC's reaction on Ullman, is that he didn't want to sign for them, so they moved him out. And I think that's good. It sets a great message and a great standard that, you know, they have their own standards at Toronto FC. And if you don't want to play for the team, then they're going to move on to the next one and give the opportunity to somebody else. So it's interesting with Ullman, whether he's in that quality of a Paul Pesciolito and can go over there and make it, then if he is, then he's made that right decision and will be good for him. But if he wasn't, then clearly that was a mistake to bypass the MLS teams. It's not to say that he would be able to come back and still get picked up, but I think his credibility and chances of that happening have diminished as a result, because you'd be dealing with some kind of failure as a young player with not making it in Europe. So it's a gamble for him, but if it's worked out, you know, good for him. That would be great, and great for Canadian soccer. But it does reflect the fact that the Canadian MLS franchises are putting in good systems. And I like, if you look at Vancouver with Russell Tebert and Bryce Alderson, what we know about those players and the character, and the three, you know, most profile young players at Toronto FC have exactly the same thing. And I think that is good standards in terms of setting what younger players should aspire to, you know. And I've talked about it a lot, you know, our last generation, as good as some of them have been, you know, as players in terms of how they've been portrayed in the media. As a former coach, I can tell you that we've had some really poor characters that have come through, and immature approaches to how it is to train, of how it is to, you know, treat coaches that you play for, and just overall about attitude. And that, as a result of MLS coming into Canada, and we're bringing in outside coaches, here's the upside of bringing in outside coaches, is that they get they get credibility. You know, people believe, because they're from the outside, people believe in what they do. So if they make decisions that are tough decisions as far as demanding attitude, the right attitude with Canadian players, everybody believes in it. So that's great. And I think that is a really good sign of what's happening within our Canadian system and Canadian MLS teams in particular.
Yeah, and you know, Montreal's just starting out in the MLS, so we haven't seen as much from them yet as we have with TFC in Vancouver, but from everything I've heard, they're on that same track, and, you know, young players like Maxime Crépeau are very mature and have a very good attitude as well. So, you know, hopefully that's something.
I think Marsh is looking to be, you know, he looks like he's a good leader. He's definitely decisive in what he does. You know, it's going to come down to what he's like as an on-field coach, but I imagine he's going to be okay.
Now, continuing on that topic of the best route for young players to take, I had a chance this past week to do what I thought was a pretty interesting interview with Bobby Graham, who is one of the more experienced youth coaches in Ontario and the director of Windstar Soccer Consulting and Academy. You know, we spoke at length on a number of interesting topics, and I want to run one of the ideas that Graham put forward. You know, one of the items that we discussed was that old debate between focusing on playing for fun versus playing to win. And Graham was pretty quick to state that he believes that winning is fun. But he did qualify that statement with the caveat that learning to play the game properly is fun, and winning the proper way is what is really fun. You know, what do you think of Graham's comments in that regard?
Yeah, no, I think it's always round. First of all, the interview itself was terrific. And again, it just goes to show, you know, that there's a lot of voices out there from people that we can learn from. You know, I learned from reading, you know, that interview. I thought it was terrific. You know, Bobby's been around for a long time. He's got, you know, really good credibility within the soccer community. He's well respected by the players that come through his system. I mean, and what Bobby Graham is a connector. Like, you know, there's all different facets and all different layers to a coach and to a manager. And one of Bobby's strengths, for sure, he's a connector. He's a connector of people as far as players connecting to coaches. He's a connector of coaches, you know, throughout the community, but also down south and even in the professional game. So I think, you know, Bobby's been in the trenches and paid his dues. So it's really good and interesting perspective, and I've said it a number of times, is that, you know, we seem to always go back to the same people that say the same things year in, year out, you know, and there's so much more out there. There really is. We just got to dig, and you won't have to dig too deep to find really interesting perspectives, because, you know, it's one thing to read newspapers. It's one thing to go on coaching courses, to get your licenses, but it doesn't mean that you know the real nitty-gritty about aspects of the game, you know. And it's not to say that you can't provide something. For sure you can. And then, it's, you know, because that's research, and you research the game. But truly, we need to respect the people that are on the pavement, that actually walk, you know, in those shoes to develop players, know what that means, know all the things that you learn from the coaching you do over the years, and even administrating the game. You know, the politics of soccer issues. Now, those are important perspectives, and I love that interview from Bobby Graham as a result. But in terms of the winning and the fun aspect, you know, I loved his answer, and I think he's alluding to that. It really is, and it's something that when we talk about the long-term player development, and we talk about, and people turn around and talk about fun, we've got to be so careful. We've got to be so careful about how we pitch that. Because on an elite level, the problem that we have in this country, and I'm sure if you were behind closed doors speaking to Aaron Binter, and he was open and not worried about being politically correct in what he would say, and not just him, but Preki and Mo Johnson even, would talk about the character and attitude of how players, Canadian players in particular, would approach training, would approach winning, would approach team environments, and I think a lot of it would be constructive but negative. It would be constructive criticism as far as Canadian players go. They don't come out publicly and say it, but you know, and the evidence is in how many Canadian players have made it, let's say from the generation that I was a part of 10 years ago, is that most of them haven't made it. And then Julian de Guzman, who was pitched in the media because of the networks on forums, whether it's Big Soccer or Voyager's forum, built him up, trying to actually get him, and everybody in the end is ultimately disappointed. So what does that all mean? It means is that our culture, because it's fun-based and because it's recreational, it's 80% recreational, is that that's how we've gone about our business. And we're pitching it now with long-term player development even more. But it truly is. We can't take away from the fact of that we need to professionalize. And this is what people like Bobby Graham, the Gary Millers, the Carlos Rivas, the Bassams, they're out there in the trenches, and even though it's a different kind of level of the game that we deal with, because it's entrepreneurial, which means they do it as a business, but they're still professionals at what they're doing. And it's and then the provincial associations and the clubs, the minor soccer clubs. But if you have it where it's too far to the left there, where it's in about having it fun first and not understanding what that means and understanding what it is to win and to have a winning mentality, you can go down the wrong, avenue of producing what ultimately want. Because Aaron Binter is coming here, and I'm sure the other two guys in the other clubs in Montreal and Vancouver, is that what he's doing is professionalizing and toughening up the players in terms of their training and how they're approaching the game and how they approach, you know, their teammates, coaches. It's all facets of it. And Bobby Graham, I thought, said it nicely as far as, you know, winning is fun. You know, even when you go out with young kids and they continually lose, you know, it's like they don't really enjoy that. It doesn't mean that you have, you know, then screaming coaches that would go crazy with young kids to make sure that they win. It's about how we deal with losing that's an important factor in this whole equation as well. Is that coaches need to, particularly the younger age groups, if your team loses, you need to put it in perspective. And it's not the end of the world, but you still strive to win. You still strive to go out and to develop and to do those things. You know, I mean, Bobby's right. It's about how the techniques of players in the younger age groups, those golden years of development, I mean, but that's existed, you know, for 20, 30 years. You know, it's like we're trying to reinvent the wheel in Canada with some of the things that some of the people say. It's been here. We've known that now for 20, 30 years. You know, it's much more about, at the elite level at least, it's about professionalizing the game here and professionalizing how the elite players are trained. And that has to be a thread, though, that goes throughout our minor soccer club system as well, so that coaches in those clubs, technical directors in those clubs, know that if they're dealing with the elite players about what those expectations are when they go to the next level. You know, and again, youth coaches, whether it was Ottman Abria, whether it was Bruce Twomley, or whether it was Dale Mitchell, would for sure have gone through this. Less so now, which is a great sign for the Sean Flemings and whoever the next, unless it's still Valerio. I'm not sure if it's Valerio is still the under-20 coach. We haven't really heard about that. But it's less so that they are dealing with players that that can't kick a ball properly or have a poor touch. But over the years, that's what you would do. You would inherit, and you'd go out and scout and recruit the best technical players that you could find, or balanced players in terms of all the components that you require. You get your best squad of 20, and you can bet your life. At that international level, you still had players that couldn't kick a ball properly and couldn't get their touch right. So for sure, those technical parts have to be put in place with a coordinated system. But to overemphasize the fun first mentality is an absolute catastrophic mistake for the elite level players that need to go on to the professional system to be able to develop and play. So it was great that Bobby said that. I loved the interview very much, and you know, he's a good man. I mean, along with, you know, the other academy people that put a lot of effort in and you know, and do things. And the other side of these guys that do that thing is just because they've along the way they've probably had enough of the politics part, you know, with football. I know it's in every industry, but in football in particular, it's here. And so the one way of diffusing the politics is to go out and run something yourself and do it your way. So they really, at least from my perspective, I really respect them very much.
As we've done in the past, I'd like to end this episode of the Paul James on Soccer podcast by getting you to answer a listener question. Rob Abichetto sent in the following email. I enjoy your podcast, Paul. I'm curious about your recent comments about Stephen Hart and your belief that the CSA should replace him with another coach. I think that would be a mistake because any coach coming in wouldn't have time to understand the Canadian players, the Canadian landscape, and how to qualify in the CONCACAF region. And where would they get the money to pay off Stephen Hart and then hire someone of real quality and experience?
Yeah, I think it's a very valid question, very valid email for sure. I think he's got some good points, you know, to be honest. But let's start with the one that addresses wouldn't know the CONCACAF region. Well, that's not necessarily true, because you could actually hire somebody that's been in the CONCACAF region and would be totally in touch with that. Being in touch with Canadian players, I agree with that. That would be tricky to learn at such a late stage. And so for my suggestion, you know, with that, I think a few weeks ago or a month ago, it could actually be a contradiction of what I would have said with Holger Osiek and Frank Yallop, because I was against that, moving out Holger Osiek at the last minute and bringing in Frank Yallop, and it was it backfired. And so that might well be the case if they were to do that now. I don't think they're going to do it, and I actually don't think they're going to do that, make that decision, because of what the listener, I can't remember his name, Steve, but the listener said with the money factor. I think the money plays a role. So we're not in England, we're not in Italy, we're not in Brazil, where they can make those decisions if need be, because they have the resources to do it. Canada is not in that position. And so it really is about, you know, recognizing the limitations that we are, you know, strung by, I suppose, in our Canadian soccer system. And again, it's also really not, I pitched it as an option, you know, and I think, again, I stand by it. You know, I'm not going to, you know, retract that. But it's got nothing to do with, you know, of what I would think of Stephen Hart as a person. Again, and he's a nice guy. Anybody that's that goes out and has the fortitude and courage to coach our national team program, like Bob Lenarduzzi, you know, same thing. Whichever way that people want to pitch Bob Lanaduzzi. I was tough with my assessment when they moved out Colin Miller about Bob Lanaduzzi. And I still stand by that, but it doesn't mean I don't respect what Bob Lanaduzzi has done and done for the game. And certainly as a national team coach, I mean, he was our national team coach for 7 or 8 years. I mean, that takes guts to be able to do that, you know. For listeners out there, and particularly the people that go out and critique and criticize that have never coached, you know, and especially part of forums, you know, it's unbelievable. Until you've been in that cauldron, you'll never understand what you deal with. So there's absolute empathy for Steven Hart in the position that he's in as far as that goes. But, where does it end? Where in Canada do we begin to start to toughen up? Do we begin to start to mature? Well, part of it is that we reason things well and we have balance. So you've got one side of the media that's completely positive and everything they say, it doesn't matter what. You know, Sportsnet along the way have been a little bit been like that, or CBC sometimes are like that. And where's the other side? How do we balance that? How do we give a different perspective? And how do we start to get somewhere in between of those thoughts? Because if we don't, we're continually going to make mistakes. And so my perspective on Steven Hart is that he's an excellent person. He's got good technical background. He's really experienced in the Canadian game. I think he should stay in a Canadian game no matter what happens. If they qualify, I will be doing cartwheels, in my living room, because I'll be so excited for the game in Canada and for Steven Hart and for being proved wrong. I've got no problem with that. But I still stand by it. You know, if you cannot motivate the players that you have, and motivation comes from not just about what you speak or from, the motivational speeches that you do before games. It's about the decisions that you make will motivate in the right way, the right behavior, the right attitude, and the right approach, and you can get that extra bit out of players and teams. And I still stand by it. I think Canada will struggle to qualify and will even struggle to maximize their potential because of the coach that we have in place. And again, if the cycle eventually comes to an end for Steven Hart, which it does and which it will, is that he should still very much be part of the technical aspects of our game in this country, as should have people like Dale Mitchell, people like Bruce Twomley, people like the Tony Taylors of the world. To me, it is absolutely sad to see, we just don't see it. We don't have the vision to see it, and we don't go about our business in the right way of strategizing programs of how we can make sure that our top people, if you've become a national team coach, it's because you've done some things right along your career path. It isn't always about politics. Politics only goes so far. There is that element of talent and quality that you have. And as a result of that, if you're in that environment, for 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, 12 years, you have got something phenomenal to offer our soccer system here, of which we have very limited resources, and particularly human resources, as far as that experience. And as a result of that, we should be able to harness it and hire it and keep it in the game, but we don't do that. You know, we have Dale Mitchell or Tony Taylor coaching. I think Tony Taylor is coaching under 10 players. You can see the positive aspect of that, but really, truly, how can that be? How can Bruce Twomley be out of the game in our country? You know, it's when he has tremendous experience. Everybody's got their idiosyncrasies as far as personalities and the way they are. You know, we get that. But once we get over that, we have to be able to challenge ourselves to be able to provide these coaches with great experience, great opportunities to continue to have a voice on our game and how it's run and how the players are developed. Otherwise, we just lose a great opportunity when we don't have any. So it's a great question from the listener.
If you have questions that you'd like Paul to address, please send your email to pauljames@rednationonline.ca.